Welcome to the Make or Miss podcast. This is your host, Seth Partnow. First, a few announcements before I get to today's guest, Lou Burris. You may notice an uptick in audio quality on this intro. I've upgraded my technology a little bit, so hopefully going forward, do a little bit better than some of the scratchy recorded phone conversation style stuff we've done in the past. The interview with Lou you're about to hear was recorded under the old method, so apologies for that, but we're working to do better. Now, before we get to Lou, just a quick intro on him. We're doing something a little different today based on previous podcasts and some articles by Professor Iago Colas. Talk to someone about the question of what is coaching. Now, if you're a basketball fan, you've probably never heard of Lou Burris. Lou is one of the most decorated college coaches of all time in the history of the sport of Ultimate Frisbee. He retired close of this past season, following his fourth national championship on the college level, three coaching the Oregon women's team, one coaching our shared alma mater, Carleton College. Ultimate Frisbee is a sport that's about 40 years old, and the newness of the sport has allowed sort of people in our lifetime to see the sport evolve from very laid back and non-structured to knocking on the door of trying to get into the Olympics and stuff like that, and how that has changed kind of the models of coaching from none at all to increasingly approaching a model that we're used to in major American sports. And Lou, I thought, would be a good person to talk about some insights of some of the pluses and minuses of various methods besides the top-down, militaristic, almost coach-as-dictator-slash-god-figure-slash-father that we've come to know and maybe not love. And I think upon some reflection, you'll recognize that a lot of the more collaborative elements we talk about are existent in the NBA, the most classic example which we talk about being the Spurs with Greg Popovich and Tim Duncan, existing more as equals rather than boss and employee. While Popovich has the last say in things, that's largely because Duncan allows that, I think. And that, I think, has some bearing on situations such as the kind of well-reported disagreements between, or apparent disagreements between, David Blatt and LeBron James. In any event, that's enough of me talking, and I'll take it away to the interview with my special guest and good friend Lou Burris.
Welcome to the Make or Miss podcast. This is Seth Partnow. I'm going to be joined today by a special guest, Lou Burris. This is something a little different than we've been here. Lou is one of the leading lights in the sport of Ultimate Frisbee, which we'll get into and talk about. But really what I wanted to talk to him about is the development of coaching, which in a young sport like Ultimate is something that he has seen from coaches being almost unethical to them being almost a requirement over the last 25 or so years. So let's talk to Lou and hope you enjoy. Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Sorry, it took a little longer. I don't. There's some sort of craziness is going on with the NBA today, and it's hard to pull myself away from breaking news.
Really?
Twitter.
How can there be craziness today?
So you know that there's like free agency. Like teams could start negotiating with free agents on the first, but they can't actually sign contracts till tomorrow. Well, DeAndre Jordan is apparently having second thoughts about having agreed to Dallas and maybe going back to Los Angeles. So craziness is ensuing.
I see, and people are like flipping their kitties about it.
Yeah, and some people are saying some pretty unfortunate things. You know, kind of the whole racialized language thing is coming out a little bit. But even aside from that, it's just great. Well, you know, it's like.
What would you say in this case they would do that?
What do you mean?
Like, what are they, like, specifically, what are they saying?
Oh, someone who's a former NBA executive tweeted then deleted something talking about how this guy or that guy wouldn't have done that because they were raised right.
Oh, and they're both white guys?
No, one of them is black and one of them is Hispanic. But, like, still, it's like, ooh, and like, be a man and, you know, live with the it's like, it's just kind of a sort of an implied ownership of, like, no. It's the kind of thing that you know, those kind of takes say more about you than the guy you're talking about kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And my own opinion on it is that any sports executive accusing somebody else of like being shady in the name of money might want to look a little bit closer to home.
That's kind of rich. And it's just weird how, you know, when the teams kind of make decisions and stuff like that, it's just business. But when a player in one instance has a chance to kind of, well, let me think about that. He's history's greatest monster. It's an odd kind of tick that living in the public life like exposes him to that. But that's kind of destroyed any chance I have of being productive this morning.
Gotcha.
Following along with it. So let me see. I already recorded like a little bit of an intro. So I'm just gonna when we start. So how did you want this to?
Yeah. So like as soon as I left, I was like, oh, I just should have talked about Frisbee and let Seth talk about whatever basketball stuff he wanted to talk about. And just sort of solidified some of what I thought would be worth talking about, and also kind of change the approach that I was taking so that I was talking about, like, I realized like almost instantly after, I was like, you know, I don't really think of it as coaching. I think of it as leadership, and like the whole, you have this whole ball of leadership tasks that have to get done for your team to be effective. And a traditional coaching model, a traditional coaching player model is just one way to do that. But you can divide it up different ways, and then I could be like, hey, these are the two main models that I've used. Boom, go.
Okay, so...
Does that seem
no,
better?
It does, and I think that framing it that way, that, you know, that like, even talking about it as, you know, scare quotes, coaching, kind of freights it with a lot of stuff that you know, it's almost begging the question, because it's
right.
We say coaching, it means these things, and really coaching isn't maybe necessary, but in or head coaching isn't maybe necessary, but leadership is, and
right.
Examining. Okay.
Yeah. You know.
So that sounds cool. So I guess I'll just pause a little bit, and I kind of, like I said, I already introduced you, and so I'll just, you know, kind of.
You made sure to say that I won 3 championships with Oregon, though, this time, right?
Oh, did I say 2?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I guess I'm re-recording that. I was doing some research before we talked, and, like, something I found said, like, hadn't won since, and I was like, I thought they won more than that, but okay. So.
Yeah, 10, 13, and 15.
Okay. Yeah, no, they did not. I thought that you guys had won recently. Didn't you beat Carlton in 13?
Yeah, in 13 we beat Carlton.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. But I, you know, anyway. All right, so do a pause and start from there. Hey Lou, how's it going?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So, in kind of your experience in Ultimate over almost 25 years now. As player, coach, leader, commentator, writer, and general kind of thoughtful person, you've kind of seen the development of the sport from kind of non-coached to coached, and that I think gives you some insight into the notion of what a coach is, should be, and how it can work in different ways.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not even sure that we are coached, anybody in the sport yet is coached the way professional sports are coached, just because nobody gets paid professional level money in any phase of the sport yet.
Sure. Why don't you, can you, for the listeners who are obviously more familiar with basketball, if they follow me, than they might be with Ultimate, can you just, a quick history and breakdown of the sport and kind of describe how that history kind of plays into the developments you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the really, I think it's one of the really appealing things about Ultimate is that the sport is so new. So as a thinker and a strategist, you have a chance to do something and think up things that nobody's ever really tried before. And the sport is still, it's still developing new directions. And only now have we gotten to the point where previously discarded strategies are like coming back in finally. And so still super young sport. I would say that modern Ultimate has probably been played for about 30 years. I'd say maybe like 86, the 86 Chicago team kind of initiating that process. And just in general, for people who don't understand Ultimate, essentially it's a giant game of keep away in the same way that basketball is let's put the ball in this little circle. You know, so it's clearly like once you involve rules and strategies, it gets way more complicated. But at its heart, it's keep away. And if any time you mess up, then the other team gets a chance. You play on a field about the size of a football field, so there is a lot of running. I think in a typical tournament, a player will run somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 10 miles, depending upon where they play, how much they play, what their job is. So that's kind of the breakdown on Ultimate. In terms of coaching, when I was a player in college, nobody had a coach at any level. And then the first round of coaches began in women's college Ultimate, and teams were really successful that had coaches. The Stanford women really had the first coach, and they won 3 titles. With her, and then in a lot of ways, I was the second coach in that division, and I coached Carleton, and we won a title in 2000, and that just kind of got the ball rolling as teams looked and were like, wow, you have this huge competitive advantage if you have a coach. And now pretty much every team in the college division has a coach, and at the club, and there's a semi-pro division, some of those teams have coaches, some of them don't. And again, when I'm saying coach, I think this should have a little asterisk next to it that doesn't look like what most people think of, like what most people think of when they hear the word coach, because people just don't have the time to put in to make that work. You know, so, you know, the time that people have, a lot of what you're looking at is kind of like what a high school coach probably would have to put in terms of they're doing their coaching around some other full-time job that they have.
So in the case of a high school coach, you're the history teacher and you also coach football or something like
right.
that.
Right, correct. So like all the time that I've coached, and I've coached 12 seasons, I had another full-time job while I was working as a coach. And that's true of every coach that I know of. So, the players as well. Nobody is making a living as an Ultimate player. There's some people who are making it a living as personalities or doing educational work or, selling Frisbee shirts, stuff like that. But nobody's making a living as a player. Nobody's getting paid a salary to play yet. So.
Sure. And I think the interesting thing that dynamic creates is it forces a different kind of dynamic of coaching rather
Absolutely.
than and I don't want to steal your thunder, but you know, you think of coaching, especially in major American sports, and you're thinking of very top down, almost dictatorial, my way or the highway kind of stuff. And that's not at all, for I think numerous reasons, that's not at all the case in Ultimate.
Right. And a lot of that is just, I think a lot of that is just a function that you don't have the time or the money. You don't have an assistant coaching staff. You don't have interns cutting apart film for you. You're doing all that stuff yourself, you know, so But also, I think that Frisbee grew out of hippie culture, really, speaking honestly about it. I think a lot of people in Frisbee want to avoid that word as much as possible. But those ideals, and particularly some of the more egalitarian and democratic ideals, still have cultural momentum in the sport. You know, I mean, a sport has a culture that goes with it, and that's part of the culture of Frisbee. And so people have been really resistant to coaching and authoritarian coaching in particular. Definitely at the beginning, when people first started getting coaches on teams, the teams that didn't have coaches kind of looked down on the teams that did have coaches. Like, what, you can't take care of yourself? Like, you have to have somebody babysit you? Like, why can't you do this? But slowly, as people have seen, like, how you just have a huge competitive advantage if you have somebody doing some of that off-the-field leadership work for you, however you set that up.
And that's the part that's interesting to get into, because I think that that your experience both on the playing and the coaching side, some of what is kind of phrased under the term coach in that leadership stuff might be more appropriately left to the people on the field, especially once you kind of get to the very top professional levels.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of different ways that you can break out that leadership work, and that's really how I think of it, is that I think of it as leadership work and not as coaching work necessarily, so that, like, and I don't have any experience playing any kind of a professional sport, but, like, outwardly what it appears to happen, and I know that's not necessarily the case of what's happening behind the scenes, but outwardly it appears that the coaching staff is making the vast majority of the decisions, and the leadership role that's left to the players is a lead by example, which is a really important leadership role for sure. Like, you have to have people doing that work on your team, but leading by example and sort of setting the emotion, like the intensity and the emotional tone that you want a team to have, like helping to keep a team focused, a lot of times I think falls on the top handful of players that you have on a team. But outwardly, at least, it appears that most of the strategic and tactical decisions are being made by coaching staff and not by players. Don't actually know if that's true, but at least from an outward, you know, that at least is sort of the mythology, at least, of how coaches work.
Sure, and I think that that's in part why I wanted to have this conversation, because certainly, I mean, I think that's in sports like, you know, baseball and football, those, I think that's very true, just because of the nature, kind of the stop-start nature of the sport allows that kind of control. I think that in basketball, and especially kind of at the NBA level, there's many examples of, you know, coaches successfully kind of ceding control, you know, kind of creating a discussion that we've frequently had prior about kind of structure versus, you know, inspiration and kind of allow that to happen. All right, here's some basic stuff. Now you guys go do what you do.
Right, like just building essentially building a strategic framework.
Yeah.
That allows people to do what they do best.
And, you know, you go up and down the NBA, coaches that call plays every time down the floor. And then there's, you know, the other extreme is Phil Jackson sitting on his hands when 29 other coaches, when he was coaching, when 29 other coaches would be calling timeout.
Right.
Because he wants the players to figure it out. And, you know, that's maybe a little bit of myth-making, but that's still, you know, when you're talking about leadership styles and strategy and tactics, there's a fairly wide range in the NBA. And I think that the level of control exerted by the coach is very much overstated in public discourse for the NBA. And that's a little why I wanted to talk to you, because the dynamic nature of the sport leads itself to that. And so I think that's a decent parallel to Ultimate.
Yeah, I think the sports are very similar in terms of the pace and the rhythm of them. I think there's a little bit more stoppage in Ultimate than there is in basketball, but I think that without going like too far down the like the like ultimate rules politics wormhole, which is a huge wormhole, of course, that's more of a function of the tournament format than it is a function of the sport itself. You know, if you were playing one game every 3 days, the game would be different.
Absolutely.
The way Ultimate is played right now is that you play 7 games in 2 days. And that's a straight function of money that, like, you don't have the money to take your team. Like, when I played for Seattle, we would have had the money to be like, oh, it's a Wednesday. We're playing San Francisco today. And then we're going to, like, play San Diego on Friday. And then we're going to, like, get in a plane and fly over and play the Texas team. Like, no, that's not, like, instead it's like, oh, we're all going to go to Las Vegas and we're all going to play each other in one weekend. And that structure has a pretty big impact on how the game gets played.
And on the body and that's line a huge, the participants. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. And that's a huge wormhole we don't want to go down. So,
yeah, no.
You know, I think one other thing that I kind of want to mention is that's not thought about at all, I think, as coaching or leadership or anything in a basketball setting, but has a huge impact on how successful you are in an ultimate setting is logistics and travel and where you're going to stay and how you're going to get there and booking flights and hotels and making sure that everybody has access to food and water and that people are taking care of themselves. It's like those are things that you don't think of as being leadership, and that those are things of being leadership skills that that when you're talking about a college team that is run by a volunteer coach and a bunch of college students, how you're going to get 24 people to Ohio during dead week, that's a huge issue, right? Because, you know, there's nobody's taking care of that. And so we have a huge portion of the leadership work that the college team does, and this was certainly true of the club team as well, is booking flights, getting hotels. A lot of times we don't get hotels. A lot of times, you know, teams are they're college kids, they're strapped, right? So we sleep on floors a lot. But then you have to like negotiate with the team that you're playing, like, hey, we're coming to your tournament. Can we sleep on your floor? But there's just a ton of the hours that go into making those things happen that they don't have like a direct competitive impact unless they go wrong. And when they go wrong, they have a huge competitive impact. And so you want to make sure that you have all those things nailed down and taken care of. You know, if you bungle your rental car, if you mess up your rental car, then instead of getting to your hotel at like 11 p.m. the night before you play, you're getting in to your hotel at 3 a.m. the night before you play. And that's, you know, it's like, it just makes a huge difference. And so, like, I think that in professional athletics, and I kind of would throw college athletics into professional athletics just because of the volume of money that's there. That those things are taken care of. You know, somebody, and I don't know who does it, if it's an office person or if it's an assistant coach or
they have travel coordinators in at the profession.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody's taking care of all that stuff for them.
I mean that is a full time job sometimes for multiple people.
I would assume so at the professional level. Sure.
I
think it would be a huge job to take care of. But that's a job that the college players have to take care of. One thing, I kind of want to back up a second, though, Seth, and,
sure.
and talk about something that we did at Oregon that has really proven to be really successful, both in terms of leadership but also competitively, is that college teams, particularly in Ultimate, are really up and down. Because what will happen is you'll have a really strong group of players come in. They'll be really successful because they're good at Ultimate, but they're not necessarily good at teaching the younger players how to be good at Ultimate or even how to be good as leaders. And so when that strong core leaves, that team will just evaporate. You know, so there are teams, you know, we played a team last year at Nationals that came within a hair's breadth of beating us and making the national title game. And then we played them this year and beat them 15-2. I mean, we just absolutely destroyed them. And that's because – go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, for people not familiar, something like 15-11 at the top level is pretty close to a blowout. So 15-2 is just a 40-point win in basketball,
yes.
Just for comparison's sake.
Sure. And that is and so something that we've done has been is to say really explicitly, we need to teach leadership all the way down, because every year in College Ultimate, you're graduating your best leaders. Every year they're gone, and every year you're bringing in new leadership. And so we say really explicitly to the players, we're teaching leadership alongside Ultimate. And so we try to give every player on the team like an actual leadership position, whether that's organizing fundraising or coordinating travel or leading warm-ups or designing our track workouts. Like I didn't do any of the designing of our conditioning, which is pretty extensive. That's a group of players design all of our conditioning for us. And so the idea being that by pushing that leadership down into the team, by giving everybody a leadership job, when those women are called on to run the team, they've had at that point 3 or 4 years of prior experience doing smaller leadership tasks, and they're much more prepared than they would be otherwise.
And that's almost in direct opposition to the professional sports establishment, where kind of player leadership training, maybe it happens, but it's certainly not in most instances, I would say, a formal thing. It's like, well, you've been around a while, ergo you're a leader.
Right. Yeah, it's funny, and which to me seems kind of crazy. Like, I mean, it definitely has had a long-term competitive boost for us, you know, so like this year I think was the 7th year in a row that we made the Final Four. And so much of that is building that leadership down into the team so that the team doesn't have a drop-off from year to year, right? So that every year we lose a ton of talent, but every year we have people who are ready to step into that. And it's not just about talent on the field. It's all the stuff that goes into, do you know how to run a practice? Like, do you know how to take the 3 hours that you have and make that be valuable to the team? But the crazy thing is that we're better on the field because of the leadership work that the players do off the field, because everybody's invested, everybody buys in, everybody's like, everybody understands this is the work that it takes. Oh, I need, you know, and when they're confronted with, oh, my forehand is awful, I need to on my own time find a way to throw because that's what the team needs me to do. They're willing to do that because it's their team. It's not me. It's not a situation of a coach being like, your forehand sucks, therefore you're not going to play. The team, this is where you are as a player, and understanding, oh, I need to work on my forehand, that's what the team needs me to do. I'm going to go do that because it's their team.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just was going to say that to me that really sort of basic level of buy-in and leadership and ownership of the team is so powerful on the field. It seems like, do you know the idea of cash on the table?
Yeah.
I guess I should just explain it anyway, but it's just this idea that strategically sometimes there's cash on the table. And I think the current sort of wonky thing that has been talked about a lot that would make sense of this is going for it on fourth down in football. The idea that like statistically it makes way more sense to go for it on fourth down, but for whatever reason, NFL head coaches aren't willing to do that. That is something that people have identified as cash on the table. It's just there for the taking. Just do it and you're going to like get this benefit. So to me, I look at leadership training as a huge opportunity that the teams would have, and it seems crazy that they wouldn't do it.
It seems like there's some of that is kind of the almost the cyclical nature of not everyone's going to be here next year, and why do I want to spend time to train you to be a leader when I might not be the coach next year, and you might not be a player here next year, and
sure.
I think that plays into it. But at the same time, what you're saying about kind of buy-in is certainly very powerful. I mean, you hear It's the kind of thing where after a team wins the title, all the stories come out about how, you know, everything went right from a team building standpoint and from buy-in. And it's like, okay, well, you know, the classic example is, and we've talked about this before, I think, is, you know, the San Antonio Spurs are
right.
They kind of in the news now that we're talking during free agency because people are taking less money to play there because it's a good place to work and they bought it.
It's a sad day, I will say, calling from Oregon. There's sadness up in this part of the world right now.
Yeah. It's, you know, it was into the NBA just a little bit. I think the handwriting was probably on the table when Wes Matthews tore his Achilles, really.
Yeah.
That kind of sadly because they've been kind of one of the more aesthetically pleasing teams over the last couple of years, but that was kind of
end, huh?
Yeah, that was kind of because it's an injury that the track record of people coming back from and being as good is in basketball especially is essentially nil. So
it's a horrible injury.
Yeah, it was a team that didn't have a ton of depth to begin with, and then it's just like. Oof. So, yeah, and my condolences. Although, with today's DeAndre Jordan news, maybe he's coming back. Who knows? No, I won't even start that speculation.
Maybe he'll be a trailblazer.
Yeah.
Rumor.
give it to sources. Sources report. So, I you touched on something that I think I wanted to talk about a little. When you talked about, you know, your individual skills are lacking. Let's get them better. In kind of the traditional model, it's more you can't shoot, you're not going to play until you learn how to shoot. And either you learn how to shoot and then you play next year, or you don't and I never see you again.
Right.
Is much more the model.
Yeah. You know, I do think that as you talk about, and we haven't gotten really into detail on this, like what types of tasks are good tasks for coaches and what type of tasks are good tasks for players. Player analysis really is a coaching task. You can get good feedback from players, but typically when you have somebody who is a coach, you're looking at somebody who has far more experience and they've probably gotten to where they've gotten to as a coach because they have a pretty good eye for players, right? Like that's, you know, you have talent of, you know, in ultimate, you have talent that's like you have speed or you have really incredible quickness or you have a really great sense of where you are in space so that you, you know, in ultimate, you talk about the idea that you can close your eyes and know where the other 13 players on the field are. A coaching talent is the ability to look at a player and understand what they are, but also what they can be, right? And coaching selects people who are good at that skill, who have the talent in that area, are going to go further as a coach, right?
Yeah. And also being good at something isn't the same as being good at teaching that thing.
Totally.
You see it. In kind of sports, oftentimes the best players have trouble on just that front when they try to become coaches or
right.
management or something like that. Because this was easy for me. How come it's not easy for you?
Sure, totally.
But
I was going to say is that's a skill, the ability to look at a player and know what they need and be able to analyze that player, and it also. And you can get better at it. But I think the thing about it is it really essentially is a coaching skill. Like that's something that coaches can do. And the one thing that I have always tried to do as a coach, and this is that when I'm going to talk about a player, I'm always going to try to show the player the path, right? So like this year on the team, we had a couple women who were having trouble catching, right? And it's funny, in ultimate, it's like catching is such a foundational skill, right, that you would think that people would approach it as a skill. But there's a sort of this weird thing in ultimate where people treat catching as almost like this personal moral failure. Like if you drop it, like you're like genuinely a bad person. And like teams will like if you have a player who has the drops, and every team has them, then that player will get like sort of like bad mouthed, or like people will like mumble about them behind their back when they drop it when they're on the field. And like, it's the weirdest thing because catching is just a skill. And so, and particularly when you talk about like, you know, we're always stealing players from other sports. Like if you have a track athlete come to play Ultimate, they've never done anything with their hands. Like, of course they can't catch, right? So what I do, and, you know, in this example, I had a couple women on the team this year who are having trouble catching. And I just said, hey, this is the deal. You need to do these drills. Boom, boom, boom. It's going to take you this amount of time, and this is where you fit them into practice. You know, when we're doing this, you need to be doing this. And then I leave it with them, like, you can do it or not do it. That's totally up to you, right? And but I think in this case, both those women took that. They took that advice. They were really conscientious about working them. These are little small drills, 2-3 minutes, right? Working through those drills, and then made big catches for us down the stretch of the season. Didn't have any trouble and fixed that. So kind of the point I'm making here is that I try not to say, you can't shoot. If you can't shoot, you're not going to play. I try to instead say, hey, this is what's holding you back as a player. This is the path that you need to follow to improve and get better so that it's not a problem for you anymore. Anyway.
Sure. No, that's I
would say, doesn't that happen? I mean, don't all good coaches do that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, the kind of a question is, what is a good coach? Was Bobby Knight a good coach? I mean, he...
Yeah. I mean, I will say, if a good coach is defined by figuring out how to get your team to win, definitely.
Yeah. No, and it's like, I mean, if you said, if it's kind of scoreboard, then by definition. But at the same time, you know... So then again, you talk to people who have been through that, like, swear by him. So who are we to say, you know?
Right.
Like, one of my favorite coaches I ever had was, like, my high school JV basketball coach. And he was a big, yelly, screamy, like, make fun of you kind of guy. But at the same time, he did it in such a way that it was always understood that, you know, that it was because he believed in you and was trying to bring the best out of you. And
yeah.
I don't know how to... you know, how he managed to communicate that, but he did. And it was so that, like, you know, I always felt like once I realized that he was doing it really for me, and it wasn't, you know, he wasn't tearing me down to tear me down. He was making a point and doing it in a way that was, you know, almost fun once you got into it.
Right.
You know, it's,
you know, I had a back when I was playing, when we didn't have coaches, but we had essentially player coaches, there was a guy who was a captain on the team who was essentially we didn't call them player coaches, but essentially was a player coach who was unbelievably hard on everybody and essentially unbelievably hard on the rookies and really intentionally set out to make us quit if we couldn't take it. Because if we couldn't take it, he didn't want us around when the chips were down. And I could take it, and it made me a far better player than I would have been without it. But I also had friends who couldn't take it, like quit playing for a couple of years, quit the team. You know, so I don't have a good answer on that one.
So, I mean, it works for some people, but then you lose others. And that, I think that probably, you know, harkening back to the NBA, like, some coaches are good for young teams and some coaches are good for veteran teams because their methodology, like, you know, it's to be a little reductive, like the yelly screamy types work with young teams because they're fresh out of college and used to being yelled and screamed at. And the more sedate ones tend to be better with veteran teams because, you know, you're talking to 30-something professionals who, you know...
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, stop the screaming, little man.
Right.
kind of thing.
I have a question, though, about that.
Sure.
Like, I always sort of thought that method of, like, yelling it, it basically breaking people down to see if they could take it, that one of the reasons that it wasn't very successful in Ultimate is that there isn't a huge supply of Ultimate players, right? So like on the team that I have, you know, essentially it's not like we had 40 super talented women and then we cut 20 of them, but that there are like 20 women languishing around the U of O campus, like wishing they were playing real Ultimate. You know, it's like we have the 20 that we have. And so to break a player down to the point where she's going to quit or she's essentially non-functional as a player is counterproductive. But I always had sort of assumed that in major sports like football and basketball and soccer or wherever, because there are so many people who played, you have the luxury of losing pretty talented people. Is that true?
I don't know how true it is. I think it probably depends on the sport. And I think almost as you go up the ladder, the less true it becomes. Like when you reach kind of NBA level of talent, you know, there's the 400 some, you know, players in the NBA, probably, you know, there's probably 450 of the 700 best basketball players in the world at any given time. And for various reasons, yes, like 200 of the others aren't available to you because they're, you know, in college still or, you know, happy on their European contracts. So it's not like, you know, you're not going to get, for the most part, it happens very rarely, but you're not going to get someone to quit playing.
Right. It's not like there's some guy, it's not like there's five guys in the D League who could replace your, okay. That's what I didn't know.
Yeah, no, okay. And even if the guy doesn't quit, you could, you know, it's losing a guy is you know, it's something that happens, and you know, that, you know, you don't, the guy doesn't quit, but he's there, but he's not really there.
Right,
you know?
Which is a horrible outcome.
Yeah.
Really bad for everybody. Bad for the player, bad for the coach, bad for the team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the, and you know, how often it happens, you know, there's, who knows? You hear repeat.
According to the media, it happens like every week on every team.
Right.
And go ahead.
Except for the Spurs, right? Because it never happens.
That's what I was going to say, except for the Spurs. But I mean, that's sort of like, I mean, they're, you know, that's a different, I mean, the media has to like, they need their clicks, right? Like,
yes.
You know, and everybody's getting along fine on the Trailblazers doesn't get quite as many clicks as, you know, whatever drama they want to cook up.
Well, when things are going well, everybody getting along gets all the clicks. When things are going poorly, then it's you know, because it's, for you know, up until, you know, midway through this year, like they were happy, fun, good story team, and
right.
You know, I'm not here to say that is or isn't true. It's just, you know, it's when you're winning, everything seems to be worth it. Is also part of it, you know. Like,
yeah.
I'll put up with this if we're winning.
Right.
This guy yelling and screaming at me, but I get a ring. Okay.
Okay.
I'll live with that. This guy yelling and screaming at me, we win 17 games. Get me out of here.
I'm out of here. So to get back on track, Seth.
Yes.
I think one of the other, so to look at kind of the breakdown of really specifically of what ends up as coaching work and what ends up as player work, right? So, and just kind of look at the two examples that I have, the one being coaching the Oregon women, which I've done for 8 years, and then the other being when I played for the Seattle club team, which I did for 10 years, spanning the 90s and the 2000s. And I just want to set logistics aside because the players all end up doing that because that's
right.
Just how it has to be.
Right.
But to really look at the, and I know that in a professional setting that work is all set aside and that there's office staff that's taking care of that work. So I don't want to think about logistics. But the other work, we talked about player analysis, I think really being a coaching job. Sub calling, I think, is really a coaching job. That's the first job I ever gave away. So I have a policy as a coach that, like, just this sort of essential idea that I have a lot of really, I have a lot of stuff that I need to be doing during a game, And the more stuff that I can give away and give away knowing that it's going to be done properly, the better. Because I have more stuff that I need to do than I actually can do during a game. In terms of like watching my own team, watching the other team, thinking about what kind of tactical adjustments we might want to make, you know, assessing, you know, I think professional coaches get just destroyed all the time for screwing up timeouts at the end of the like in end of game situations. There's so much going on at the end of a game, and like it's so easy to sit on your sofa and look at the TV and be like, "You should have called the timeout," but like there's so much going on, right? And yeah, so many things that are in the air that you're trying to take care of. So I had this idea that like I want to get rid of everything I can. Because if I can get rid of it and make sure that it's happening, that then frees me up to do this other more essential stuff that, that other people cannot do. And so, go ahead.
You know, and this seems like that's a good point to, you know, when we're talking about your playing career, like in a leadership role, you know, if we're talking about, I think the genesis of this conversation, we're halfway through and we're just getting to, is kind of the some thoughts on kind of the David Blatt, LeBron James situation. So who's actually running that team? And what you're talking about is, I think, is equally true for either guy, for either like the star best player or the coach, however that model is. Like, you know, I never reached the level as a player in Ultimate that you did, but like the year I was best, I also was in charge of calling subs for a team, and I couldn't play. Like, I couldn't play myself because I was using too much energy calling subs to be good enough to, and you know, for a guy who's a marginal player like me, that's fine. So I don't play. For LeBron James to be, you know, losing, you know, focus on the game to worry about that, that's devastating. Yeah. So of course it should be someone else doing it.
Yes. And he should want it to be someone else. That I think is sort of my broader point, is that anything that you can give away makes your team deeper, and depth is clearly a huge advantage in athletics. Depth can lose. I mean, I've seen depth. I've had depth and lost. But generally speaking, all things being equal, the deeper team always wins. So anyway, subbing is the first thing I gave away, and I always give it away. And one of the reasons that I give it away is that it is 90 to 95% of that work can be decided upon ahead of time and is just enacting the plan. You know, so if it's like, hey, we're going to run, when we're on defense and the other team's going downwind, we're going to play zone. And when we're on defense and the other team's going upwind, we're going to play man-to-man, however that works, right? And that's all decided ahead of time. And so that your sub caller knows, like, oh, this is my zone lineup. I just call my zone lineup, and they go. And that process of figuring that out ahead of time can be done for any sport, right? Like the craziest, of course, is football, where they're always like, you know, they got even pro football, they still have 55 guys on the sideline, and they're like shuttling them in and out. But all that's decided ahead of time. Nobody's like, you know, I really feel like Tom Brady's feeling it. We're going to have him play cornerback today. Like it's all ahead of, like everything's already all figured out, right? And so that's a job that, as a head coach, definitely you should give away. Like, I've given it away to freshmen before. So, like, if you have – there have been a couple of years that I coached, particularly early on, where there were freshmen or sophomores on the team – who had knee injuries. So like ACL injuries, super common in women's athletics. And those players, even as freshmen and sophomores, gave them the clipboard and said, "This, you know, you're calling subs, this is what we're doing," and work through them on that process of doing it. And then that's a huge task. You know, that's essentially, it's 30 seconds every possession. You know, I don't know what the basketball corollary there would be, but like, it just is a huge amount of time that I don't have to be thinking about this pretty simple task, right? You know, the other stuff that I give away is the moment-to-moment play calling. You know, so like basketball Ultimate, you run set plays in certain circumstances. I'll talk with the play callers, who typically are not the captains because they have other work that they have to take care of, but typically with the play callers for the offense and the defense, I'll talk with them before the game and be like, hey, this is our general plan. You should think about doing these plays. But she's making that decision of, this is the personnel grouping I have. We're going to run, we're going to run split pairs, or we're going to run a vertical stack, or we're going to run a side stack, or whatever we want to run. She's making that decision out of the conversation that we had leading up to the game. And the same is true on the defensive side. We may say, hey, we're going to give you a zone package, but the woman who's running the defense, she'll pick which zone she wants based on the personnel that we've given her and the conditions.
How much of that, I think that's a really interesting thing because, again, tying back to the NBA, that issue of kind of play calling and, who has both kind of the mental energy aspect of it, but also who has a better idea of what's going on is, and so how much of that is just kind of, like you said, your time and mental energy, and how much of it is, she's on the field, she sees, all right, this defender is slacking, we have an advantage there, let's exploit that this way.
Right.
Something that you might not, you from your vantage point on the sideline, can't really
know. I may not know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, there's so much that goes on the field, right? Like, I may not have recognized that the deep fill is getting this incredible mismatch that we should be exploiting. So-and-so rolled their ankle and she can't actually run. Like, we should isolate her defensively. I just a couple things. Number one, coaches are not perfect, right? They make mistakes. And so players are going to see things that coaches don't see. And so if you have that decision-making process spread out, you have the opportunity to take advantage of those things. The second thing is that because my project as a coach is really heavily involved in teaching leadership and not just winning ultimate games, I'm okay with them making decisions I don't agree with. Because what kind of leader can only make decisions you agree with? That's not really leadership, right? Like, does that make sense?
No,
So across the course of a season, both large and small, they'll make decisions that I would do differently. And there'll be times where they'll say, hey, we're going to run this defense. And I'll just be like, ooh, I hate that D. I won't even say anything. You'll be like, cool, go do it, And sometimes I'm wrong, Sometimes there's certain defenses that I'm just prejudiced against. And so but that players like, and so they'll run them. And I'll be like, okay. And other times I'll argue, I'll make my case about, I really think we should do this. And sometimes they'll be like, yeah, they'll agree with me. Typically though, if all three captains are united against me, I won't push them. I've never put my foot down against all three of the captains united. Just cause it's important to me that it's their team and not my team. And if I'm going to overrule all the leadership, that means it would be my team.
Sure. I wanted to touch on something you and sorry for bouncing around on you here.
Sure.
But you are talking about, and this is, I think, a really interesting aspect, is over the course of a season. Now, kind of is, in your mind, again, assuming that you, admitting that coaches make mistakes, but, more often than not, you'll have the right of it. Is your hope that they will kind of through this trial and error and learning process and allowed to make mistakes, that by kind of the end of the season, when it matters the most in terms of, high stakes wins and losses, to the extent that's a real thing in sports.
Yeah. I should say that, we win more than we lose.
Yes.
Okay.
But that through that kind of that trial and error and taking on that leadership, that they'll have learned to kind of get to not necessarily the right, but a right answer by that very important time of the season. Is that a conscious thing, or is that something?
It's funny. It's less about, I think about it just a little bit differently in the sense that it's less about making correct decisions and more about making real decisions. And if you only have the room to make decisions that somebody else agrees with, what kind of decisions are you actually making? But I will say that the team, I think over the scope of things, does learn from their mistakes. You know, in 2014, so not this most recent season, but the season before, we played a huge dogfight of a game in the semifinals, the national semifinals. And it was the tournament was in Ohio in May. It was like super hot. We played on turf, so the turf's got those black beads in it that, like, you know, so like the 2 feet, that, you know, like the 2 feet, the 2 feet from the field up is like 120 degrees, right?
Yeah.
And we played a 17-16 game. And it was a defensive bloodbath, so the game took forever. And it was in the middle of the afternoon, and we got done, and we were exhausted, like just flat, destroyed, cooked. And the team that we were going to be facing the next day, exceptionally talented team. And I knew that we should go back to the hotel. I was like, we need to hydrate and stretch, and we need to go back to the hotel and lay down and take a nap and, like, just get out of the sun. However, the Oregon men's team was playing the semifinal directly after ours. And so the team was like, we want to go watch this game. And I was like, this is crazy. We want to win. We need to leave the sun. And they're like, no, we want to watch the game. And so I made my case really strongly. Like, if we want to win, if we're serious about what we're doing here, we need to leave and go back to the hotel. And the team decided, no, we want to watch the game. We stayed and watched the game. And definitely a mistake. Like, we lost the game. I don't know if we would have lost. We might have lost anyway because the team that beat us was really good. And we were really beat up and injured and damaged, but we didn't do ourselves any favors. So then going into this year, we were confronted with the exact same situation. But as a leadership team, we actually had discussed the potential for this situation happening. So, like, having had it happen once, we'd all learned from that situation. We talked about it again and actually ahead of time decided if we need to make that decision in the moment, the team decided that I would make that call. So that, like, they freed themselves from putting themselves kind of in that social bind, right? Because Frisbee teams are really socially connected, the men's and women's teams are. They freed themselves from making that decision and said, Lou, you're going to make that decision going in. And so when we got to that spot where we are weighing going to cheer for our men's team versus taking care of ourselves physically, I went ahead and made that decision. But that was because the team had decided that I would make that decision. So that's kind of how that process worked.
Sure. So it's maybe a little bit of both, just kind of the learning through trial and error, and but also just the actual as opposed to false leadership.
I mean, I think what's interesting about this is that, like, I ended up making the decision, but it was because we as a group decided that I was going to make that decision.
Yeah.
And that's a model that we use a lot, which is, like, we try to be as democratic as possible, but democracy is unbelievably inefficient. And when you're in a game situation, you need to be efficient, right? You don't want to be like, you don't want to be calling in all 20 people and be like, hey, like, this is
what,
like,
the
important point of our season. Like, what play should we run? Like, let's talk about it. No, like, somebody needs to be making that, like, a person needs to be making that decision. And it needs to be clear ahead of time who's making that decision so that it's settled. And that you can go forward and everybody can trust that person's going to do a good job of doing their job. The process of deciding who that's going to be, that can be a really democratic process. And that I think is the model that we use, which is we work together to decide who's going to be the dictator in their own area, whether it's calling plays on offense or whether it's setting up the defense or whether it's, you know, deciding whether or not we're going to leave the field at this particular time. So
I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask anyway. Is, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter who you decide should be the quote unquote dictator in those situations. As long as, I mean, it matters in that you want someone who's going to make the right or not A rate, good decisions at least.
Yeah.
It doesn't, as long as you decide someone and people are okay with that. So getting back to like the LeBron David Blatt thing, if LeBron is calling the plays and they've decided that it's okay that LeBron is calling the plays, who cares? Like that's
or it could be like David Blatt's going to call like 90% of the plays or like 95% of the plays. But periodically, if LeBron decides that he wants to overrule David Blatt, he can do so. You know, so like that's a model that we've used a lot, that I've used a lot in terms of running subs, is that the person who's the sub caller will run subs. But if I want to make a change, I'll just step in and make a change and be like, you're out, you're in, you know. But that's something that we had talked about and that we had sorted out ahead of time.
And the key point though is that there's no one way it has to work. It's just as long as it's a way that you've kind of collectively or some version of collectively decided on is how it's going to be and go from there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you could have one person totally do it. One person, a different person do it. You could have, I think you could even probably have two people do it because they could get that relationship so that it snapped along pretty quickly. Like, hey, what do you think about, like, should we run cross? No, they're poaching too much. Why don't we run, let's spread them out and run German. Like, whatever you want, like, whatever play you're going to want to run, like, that decision could be made between two people even pretty quick. Yeah, so.
And that's actually something you see kind of, again, to, you know, you see it, for example, the Spurs throw the timeout, like Popovich will go, they come into a timeout, Tony Parker, Tony, what do you want to run? What are you seeing? Okay. And then they sit down and then Popovich draws up that play or something like that.
Right.
And that's, I think, across, and that, I don't want to make it sound like that's just the Spurs who do things right and nobody else does.
Sure.
I think that's very common for teams with kind of the star heady players because, you know, I think you've experienced this kind of when you have a very experienced, very good player. Part of the reason they're very good is that they know how to recognize and make those kind of decisions. And
yeah,
why wouldn't you rely on that?
Right. I do a ton of that kind of stuff where I'll give away little decisions in the moment. Like, hey, the team needs this. Can you take care of it? Or would you decide about this? And that's something that I don't think we ever really sat down and talked about, but just happens kind of organically within the team.
Sure.
So
what are we, I think we've talked a lot about kind of the strengths of kind of this, you know, you put it more egalitarian model. What are some of the drawbacks?
I can speak really strongly to the drawbacks of what I have done, which is, I don't know how much of it is you can separate out for me stylistically as a coach, so that like I'm very much a defense first, offense second coach, so that all the teams that I've ever coached have been criticized for essentially sloppy play on offense without going into too much sort of ultimate specific stuff. And so I think that the propensity in there where you have broad control as opposed to specific control, I think it's more difficult to get a really tight, cleanly controlled team. It's much easier to play a strategic style that is looser, sloppier, more creative, depending upon if you want the positive or negative adjective
right
on it. And that style definitely has weaknesses, so that it like when you're giving individual players the freedom to create, it can be unbelievably beautiful. It can also be like stultifyingly horrible to watch. Like it can be terrible. And I think that inconsistency is probably built into that system.
To get it to tie back to the NBA, you basically just described the Russell Westbrook experience. In kind of what, like when people talk about let Russ be Russ, it's exactly that. Like it can be amazing and it can be terrible, and you know you kind of can't have one without the freedom to do the other. And so when, and just to clarify, when you're talking about like sloppy, it's kind of almost big play heavy and star dominant. Would that be kind of a one way of describing it?
Yeah, big play heavy, star dominant. I don't know if I'm not sure that I would say star dominant, and I don't want to go too far down like specifics of like ultimate strategy, because I think one thing that's different about ultimate from basketball is that you can't run with it. Like there's no corollary to dribbling in ultimate. So if you can imagine basketball without dribbling, that's kind of what you're thinking about, right? So you have to pass it to other people. So a lot of the times what would be a ball hog in basketball is somebody who's like trying to create just by throwing. They're not letting the motion away from the frisbee create openings for them. They're trying just through their own like heroic ability to throw the frisbee to create those openings. I think that in terms of sloppy play, like we play fast, like we're an up-tempo team, which I think suits a creative team better. And so you only have a certain amount of time to throw it, essentially like a little tiny little miniature shot clock. And we throw a lot of turnovers early in the stall count. And people are like, why didn't you just wait till you had something better? I think the basketball corollary would probably be a fast break team that like, they shoot bad jumpers like 3 seconds into the stall count or into the shot clock. You're like, what are you doing? Right. But that's sort of like the whole team persona is like run. And like, you know, that's a weakness of that system.
And I think that, I mean, the Warriors just won a championship playing a style where, you know, they had some ugly turnovers because they're trying to, you know, they're trying to get out and run and you know, be creative and take some crazy shots. And sometimes that doesn't work out, but on balance, they won way more than they lost this year with it. And so,
Right. I think that it has its weaknesses, but the same way that structured teams have weaknesses, right? Just that these weaknesses would be different. I think that a team that is more democratic has a really hard time holding individual players accountable. I've experienced that certainly some as a coach, but way more when I was a player and working as a player coach or under player coach systems is that you just didn't really have a good mechanism for holding. You certainly didn't have any way to hold a needed player accountable for the things that they did wrong. I played with somebody who insisted on throwing throws that they did not have. And we didn't have any way to control that. A coach team, particularly a coach team where the coach is making more of those decisions, that kind of thing just it'd be nipped in the bud right away.
There's obviously the dynamics in the NBA are very different, but or maybe not. I mean, you know, you talk about a guy who's really good but does whatever he wants and no one can say anything. I mean, kind of latter day Kobe Bryant a little bit.
I was thinking more about like a player like, and I'm not going to know the person, so you can supply the person, but like
J.R. Smith.
Kind of like take a prototypical power forward rebounder defender who cannot shoot at all and give them this incredible propensity to like want to shoot jumpers from the elbow. And so like every time they catch it there, they're like trying to make this like 12-foot jump shot. Right? Now on a coach team, doesn't that just get controlled immediately?
It depends on the level of play you're talking about. I think,
but at the NBA level, doesn't that not happen?
If you're hearing a loud noise in your ears, it's everyone listening right now yelling the name Josh Smith. If you described him, you've described him kind of, he was like a guy who, you know, like a guy who raises up for a jump shot and like the crowd, no.
Right.
And you know, that's an interesting case because he was like, he was, you know, nitty gritty, but he was a guy who got waived the last season with an unprecedented amount on his contract, which, you know, people who follow me know I think was the worst personnel move of last season. But anyway, he got, because of that one thing, like he was, you know, sabotaging to some degree a not very good anyway team by doing that.
Yeah.
But other teams that thought that they could handle that, and whether it was coaching or a system that wouldn't allow that to happen, like he got waived and every smart team was lining up to sign him. Like the next day.
And then here's my question is, did it get fixed? Like when he went to his new team, did he quit doing it?
No, but they didn't put him in a position where it mattered as much.
Gotcha.
They found a way to, you know, around it. And, you know, in Houston, he had the ball less. And when he got the ball, he was in spots where he was, other options that he was better at were more available to him. I mean, he still took bad jumpers, but they went in a little bit more. And
didn't he win a game for them? I sort of vaguely remember that he won a game for them in the playoffs.
I mean, he played really well for them in the playoffs. He had a game in the playoffs where, because he was put in a position where, you know, he has, for the big guy, very good passing skills. He had like 9 assists in one game.
Right.
Because he was put in a position where, instead of taking that jump shot, I can now throw a lob to Dwight Howard or
right.
to hit a shooter in the corner or something like that.
Right.
Which I would prefer to do anyway, but on my old team, those weren't open, so I shot.
Yeah.
I think that the analogy, even if it's not perfect, is certainly
right.
apt.
I think something that is probably pretty rare on professional or even on college teams is endemic on ultimate teams. There are very few teams that don't struggle with that issue to some degree or another, because they're all uncoached and because there isn't free agency. It's like if a guy has talent and he lives in your city, like you want him to play for you because you can't cut that guy and then get another equally talented guy out of free agency. It just doesn't, because people have jobs. Like you can't be like, oh yeah, I'll go.
You can't trade him for someone who fits better.
Correct. So you have to make the pieces that you have work. But what that means, that in company with player leadership and this more democratic thing, just means that it's way harder to hold people accountable. So that would be, I think, the biggest weakness probably.
This is kind of, I guess, less of a – maybe it isn't less of a problem. Let me ask you about this. Is kind of a related but kind of a discipline issue. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, you see this all the time with, like, you know, a college kid gets arrested for blah. And obviously that's not as big of a problem. But then again, like, we've played with people who – in college, you know, ended up at a night in a drunk tank or something like that.
Sure. Or, you know, I had a woman a few years ago get a DUI. You know, or every now and again, one of them will get MIPped. They're college kids. You know, they make mistakes.
Yeah. But certainly at kind of I'm thinking now more of the club level. Is there a way to hold someone like you say, accountable for that or to deal with that internally? Or is that just something that's outside the purview of what the team even is because of the nature of the sport?
Well, you're in it's a funny situation, right? Like it's not a discipline issue because we're not in the public eye, you know, so that like, you know, if, you know, like, you know, I'm coaching at Oregon and if an Oregon football player gets a DUI, it's like it's above the fold on the sports page, you know, and Mark Helfrich has to have a press conference about it and talk about what's going to happen. And the kid has to like apologize and, you know, all this stuff. Right. And for me, I think the bigger issues that have been mental health issues and, you know, a lot of young people, particularly as they get into college. I just think in general people have mental health issues, but then when they get into college, those issues are really exposed for the first time. And so helping people deal with mental health issues, that would be, I think, a huge part. It's not a discipline issue. It can manifest itself as discipline problems, right? Like, if somebody has a mental health issue, if they have, you know, somebody has depression and they're self-medicating with alcohol, particularly if that person is like a 6'8", 250-pound athlete, that can become a discipline issue pretty quick, right?
Yeah.
And not just and not even necessarily that, like, they're doing anything worse. It's just that they're bigger and more public. You know, it's like, again, that same talking about U of O football players, like, if, you know, if one of the women that I coach, like, is drunk and, like, picks up a trash can and chucks it in the street, it's like nobody notices. Not that that's actually happened, but I'm just using that as an example. But if, like, the tight end for the Ducks does the same thing, like, five people have it up on Twitter in, like, 30 seconds, you know? And it's, so it's just, like, part of it's just the exposure that it's – that because we're so under the radar, it's not a discipline issue. But it is a mental health issue. And so, like, you know, like, I have done a lot of work in terms of helping people find the right place to go to get help, because, like, I'm not a professional counselor, so, like, I got to try to get them to the right spots. And then I think the really the tough one, the one that I really have had a hard time figuring out how to deal with, is substance abuse. And, you know, particularly I think alcohol has been, I think it's pretty epidemic in sports culture. And you just put that much alcohol and that many young people together, and some of them are going to turn into alcoholics for sure. And finding a way to get help for those people has been really really challenging. Both identifying who actually needs help and how to get them the help they need, and do they even want the help? Do they see the need? You know, it's that's really been a thorny issue. But again, I've been fortunate that it hasn't been a discipline issue. It's been more of like, I mean, it really is like a community and a family issue.
Sure.
We have somebody here who's our friend, who's part of our sort of broader team family, who's having these issues. What can we do to help them out?
Sure. And that probably would have been a better way to phrase what I meant by a discipline issue anyway. But so
yeah
we'll go with, we'll definitely go with that instead. I just
right.
Lacking the terminology.
And so, that, you know, and that's one of the, that's something that, again, in terms of this idea of pushing leadership down, is that when players have had struggles in these areas, that we will, you know, I will, a lot of times they'll lean, like if you have a mental health issue, a lot of times players are leaning really heavily, often in an, to an unhealthy degree, on their friends. And their friends want to be friends, and so their friends want to have them, they want to help them carry that weight, right? Because that's what you do for a friend. But at the same time, it's not sustainable, it's not healthy. And so, like, talking, trying to help people understand what it means to be, like, a good advocate and a good ally for somebody in that situation, and how you go about doing that, and where you want to press, and how you want to press, and how to be supportive to make that stuff work. So.
Sure. We have gone very far afield.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like,
yeah,
wow, we went a long way from where we started.
Yeah, no. So I don't even know if there's a way to go back and sort of,
well, I mean,
I will
try to bring it back, which is to say that, again, if you think about it, about all this stuff is leadership and not coaching, and that as a leader, however you divide that work up, as a leader within a community, when the people in your community are facing difficulties, that's your responsibility, right? And within the way that Frisbee players and coaches deal with them is going to be different from the way they're going to be dealt with in a professional sports complex like situation, because there you're talking, I mean, there's vast amount of money involved, there's this huge public relations situation involved, you have the whole employee employer situation, which I think makes the waters really muddy. Like, I can, like, if I'm helping one of the women that I coach with a substance abuse issue, right? Like, I'm very clearly doing that in an un, like, it's a un, what's the word I'm looking for?
non-supervisory kind of.
Yeah, I'm not supervisory. I'm not, like, I'm not signing her paycheck. I'm not, it's my, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, I'm not on two sides of the fence. I'm just on her side. I'm not on her side and on the side of the organization.
Right.
You know, and if you would count a coach as sort of being their own professional brand, that sort of creates a third side, I would think,
right.
You know, like, you know, and those issues, I mean, I don't know a lot about them, but the way they're dealt with publicly, at least, is very different from how we've dealt with them in Ultimate.
Sure.
But they still have to be dealt with.
Yeah. And an interesting thing that you were talking about is kind of the hierarchy is certainly, you're talking about a coach and the star player. You know, the coach is not above the star player on the org chart in any way.
Yeah.
And that almost would necessitate, you know, adopting some of the things that we've been, and I think successful organizations do, but without necessarily being publicly kind of acknowledged that, you know, you're talking about more of a partnership than a bond.
Right. I mean, it is interesting though, that like you mentioned, as we were talking before we went on the air, that like that Popovich and Tim Duncan really see themselves as a partnership. Are they the only people that talk about? Are they the only coach star tandem that talks about it in that way?
I sincerely doubt it. They're the
but like,
the
but they publicly talk about it in that way.
Pretty close too. I mean, probably a part of that is you know is in terms of public ego, Duncan is pretty low on kind of the superstar list.
Right,
and as is Popovich, really. I mean, he's a guy who, you know, anytime you ask him, will say, "Oh, I didn't do that." Like, and it's not, "I didn't do that." And this is kind of an anecdote I've kind of used before, but he's saying, he's not, "I didn't do it." Like, it's not my fault. It's like he made jump shots, I didn't. So
right.
Talk to him.
Right.
You know, and he's you know, I helped. I put him in position. I had him on the floor. He did it. And so he's very willing to kind of allow credit to flow elsewhere, and because, you know, winning is its own reward kind of thing. If we're going to be like super, super happy, you know, hippie about it almost.
Right. Yeah, I would be really curious, and I mean, there's no way to know for sure, but I'd be curious how much of it was Duncan and how much of it was Popovich.
You know, Popovich has consistently said, you know, I can be hard on this team. I can coach this team hard because Timmy lets me. You know, some rookie in free agent camp who's a, you know, first round pick with a guaranteed deal comes in and he sees, you know, inner circle Hall of Famer Tim Duncan get yelled at and just nod his head, yep, and do it better the next time. I guess that's how we do it here. And that doesn't mean that, and part of that is Popovich doesn't abuse that, obviously. Like,
right.
I don't, even the most docile superstar in the world, you know, probably doesn't deal well with the Bobby Knight kind of style. Like, he would never have worked in the NBA because of that.
Right.
So, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just was curious, just thinking to like bring back into the NBA, do you think that there are other coaches or GMs or leaders or players who look at that? Because like so much of sports is about imitation and about stealing from other people, right? Who look at their relationship and the way that team functions and say, that's a model that we should try to steal from in terms of developing a healthy organizational culture and then really intentionally trying to copy it?
It's the
Has
kind of
anybody
thing that,
done that?
I think teams have tried. I think, like, the Warriors seem very much like they were trying to copy that this year, and that's, I don't think, terribly surprising since Steve Kerr, you know, played for Popovich as a player. And, you know, what was one of the bigger stories to come out of the finals is like the game changing or the series changing strategic move, which I think they win the series anyway, but it was, you know, it was still a good move of changing their starting lineup came from like the 28-year-old, assistant coach who has worked his way up from, a film guy working with Steve Kerr for back when he was in Phoenix. And they were very publicly like, this was this guy's idea, it's a, a healthy organization that you do well. We all work together. Everyone looks better. Everyone will get more opportunities in the future. And, their lead assistant got a head coaching job this year, just like, assistant coaches for the Spurs go on and get head coaching jobs with kind of mixed success, but it's a cooperative model that allows people to work together and not have kind of agendas and stuff like that. And it's easy to say that's good, but it's kind of like it's also a prisoner's dilemma, right? I can get ahead by stabbing this guy in the back.
Sure.
Well, now I got people looking behind me, and then all of a sudden your culture is that's your culture, and that's it's a chicken and the egg thing. Like, do they have that culture because they win, or do they win because they have that culture, or is it self reinforcing? And I think it's a lot of both, I guess. So it's
like, sure.
Sure, you can try to imitate that. Find a superstar who doesn't care that much about being yelled at, or if he gets public credit for stuff, and find a coach who's willing to back off and cede control and be seen to cede control, and surround them with other Hall of Famers, and there you go, easy. Why doesn't everyone just do that?
Right.
So,
one of the things, another thing that we had talked about being off the air was like talking about how people have kind of inherent weaknesses, right?
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like everybody comes in with weaknesses, and a lot of times your weaknesses, they can be tied to your strengths. They're not always tied to your strengths. A lot of times what I look at as major weaknesses, as major blocks, are not technical abilities, but sort of mental abilities, how you cope with these kinds of issues that we're talking about, right? I was struck with this idea that I talk about with my team all the time, which is whether you're doing hard work, whether you're doing easy hard work, right? So just to explain that concept, I ran track and cross country when I was in high school before I started playing ultimate. And so for me, like, I like going out and running repeat 400s. Like, that's good times,
And crazy
so
person.
That's hard work, but for me it's easy hard work, right? Whereas I'm not a terribly disciplined person with a Frisbee. Like, I like throwing crazy stuff. And so to find the mental discipline to hold that in check, that was very difficult for me to do as a player. And that's the hard work. And that's the work, it's the hard work that you have to do in order. Can you hold on for a sec, Seth?
Yeah.
Come on in. Helen's watching Cora upstairs, okay?
So, like, you take, like, to go back to this idea about copying the Spurs, is if you're a superstar and you're going to know better who these superstars are than I am, who have this incredible drive to win and this incredible force of will to win, then the challenge for them is to take that force of will and turn it on themselves to sort of see that, to see that, like, oh, I need to take the prisoner's dilemma in this direction. Like, I have this incredible will to win. That's how I got here. That's how I'm successful in the NBA. I now need to take this incredible will to win and turn it on the relationship I have with my coach and with the other players on the team, and drive that relationship in a way that gets us as a group where we need to go, because I can't win by myself.
And so applying kind of some specifics to that, it's not just like, okay, I have standards, we need to do it right, rah, rah, rah. It's like, okay, it might feel good for me to yell at this guy. How does that actually help, aside from making me feel good in the moment?
Or I have a problem with my coach because of this. Well, like, if the superstar has all the power in that relationship, they should just fix it. that's their, it, like they, that's their issue that they can fix, right? Now, not every relationship can be fixed, right?
Right.
But that, but the, but instead of being pissed at the coach about whatever it is, to then say, let's get this fixed. Like, let's get this relationship healthy. Let's get it so that we are a partnership, because only as a partnership are we going to be successful.
Right. And I think one thing, I mean, it's a lot of people are probably going to hear that and say that, you know, one or both of us is advocating that, like, Cleveland should just fire David Blatt. And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, I think that...
I don't know enough to know if...
Yeah, well, but if... And just, like, you know, necessarily someone, like, one person barking at another person in, you know, situations of competition, it's not the end of the world.
It doesn't mean much at all.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I'm fair to say that, you know, we've known each other a long time, and you know, we've certainly had, you know, incidents like that in heated situations, and it's not...
I don't remember any of them.
What's that?
I don't remember any of them.
I remember them all. but it doesn't, you know, partially it's because, you know, we were friends before that happened, but still that happens. And if that never happened, this is something we talked about before in kind of the lost version of this podcast, you know, if you're never having kind of those conflicts, that, you know, you don't, those conflicts aren't good, but if you never have them,
right,
that's probably a problem.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And, you know, if you're never getting in the scuffles, maybe are you pushing yourself hard enough? Does it mean enough to you to put that much of yourself into it? And at this level, you know, that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, on the team you coach or in the NBA finals, like, that's, you kind of need that to be at that level, because the other guy certainly does too. The other guy certainly has it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is that you just, the challenge for all the outside observers who are watching that happen is that there's no way to distinguish, healthy from unhealthy, right? You can't look at that argument and be like, oh, this argument is cool. These guys have a relationship, a working relationship where they can yell at each other and it's not a big deal. Or these guys genuinely don't like each other and this whole thing is broken. There's no way to tell, like, from the outside, you can't tell the difference.
And as an observer, you could find facts to fit either narrative.
Yeah, of course.
And then, you know, and you talked earlier about, you know, and then you, and there come your clicks from.
there come your clicks.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, shoot, if you're smart, I mean, I guess, again, I don't know a whole lot about how sports media works on the inside, but, like, you would really think as an editor that you'd want to have somebody arguing both of the cases.
You have just described ESPN's daytime programming.
Yes.
you have explained the existence of Skip Bayless in one sentence. So,
right. Great.
So, yeah. So I don't know. I feel like we've covered a broad range of stuff and maybe gone a little bit, you know, off the track that we thought about, but I think that we just a good kind of food for thought about how there's the way that we're used to as sports fans, you know, seeing this thing done isn't the only way it can be done, and there are kind of other models from either other sports or, you know, other things
and I'll just end with a lament that, like, this kind of stuff is endlessly fascinating to me. And when I watch sports, this is one of the things that I watch, is how the relationships happen between coaches and players and between the other players. And it's sad that we don't ever actually get to know what happens, because it would be really cool to actually know what actually was happening.
And just to see if there, like, what the differences are, if there actually are differences between, like, the good teams and the bad teams, or everyone acts the same way and the good teams just have more talent.
I don't think that's true.
No, I don't think that's true either. Yeah, but the degree to which that stuff, like, yeah, anyway.
Sure.
So, I mean,
go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, you can't be horses with ponies, but there are you can squander talent.
And then it happens kind of every year that there's like some talented teams that just, you know, don't work.
Sure. I mean, and the other thing to think about is that, like, if you look at the NBA, there are a lot of really good teams, and only one of them gets to be a champion. You could have a team that was incredibly talented and incredibly well coached and go about doing everything the right way, and they could still not win. Just because there are other teams that are also incredibly good and incredibly well talented and incredibly well coached. They can't all win.
It's funny because I was talking about just this on a podcast or yesterday with an NBA gambler who we were talking about how big a role it's for lack of a better term, luck plays into, you know, the top level. It's really, we're talking a game where 200 points is scored and 2 points is the difference oftentimes. I mean, that's a lot of narrative writing on the coin flips.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And if you're talking about 2 points, in some ways you might just be talking about who got the ball first.
Yep.
Which is, yeah.
It's very much a kind of a butterfly flaps its wings kind of thing.
Totally.
But in any event, we've gone about 90 minutes, which
I know.
This was
you're going to run it at double speed, right? So it fits in 45.
No, I might find a way to break it up in the middle and run it as two parts, or I'll just dump the whole thing post the whole thing and
right.
And people will listen or they won't, and there we go. This was. You know, off the beaten path of kind of what I normally do, but it's an interesting topic, and you have interesting things to say about it, so I thought we'd chat about it. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Great to talk to you, Seth.
Yeah, you too, and enjoy the rest of the day with your kids.
I'm gonna.
Talk to you later.
Okay, bye.